Good evening. I'm Fiona Branton, president of the Law School Forum, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all. Tonight we're happy to have with us Ms. Judith Martin, who was born a perfect lady in an imperfect society, and is now devoting her life to leading the way towards a more civilized and more cheerful society. Although she was born in Washington, D.C., Ms. Martin is not a stranger to the Boston area. She received her education at the most civilized of schools, Wellesley College. She then returned to Washington to work for the Washington Post, covering social life at the White House, the embassies, and the zoo, before becoming a film and drama critic. Ms. Martin has been answering questions on etiquette and social behavior through her nationally syndicated Ms. Manners column since 1978, in which her readers seek her assistance on subjects ranging from romance to table manners and everything in between. In addition to writing her column and lecturing, Ms. Martin is the author of several well-respected guides to etiquette and social behavior, as well as two novels. She's also entered the age of high technology with a home video on how to properly plan the perfect wedding. On a more personal note, this morning I was privileged enough to accompany Ms. Martin to a radio appearance that she did locally. And I learned all kinds of things on how to improve my own social life. I have no doubt that the law school will be a better place to live if we all heed Ms. Martin's advice tonight. It's my pleasure to present Judith Martin.
Thank you very much. I feel extremely honored to have been asked to bring my dear little subject matter of etiquette to this august institution dedicated to that majestic and mighty subject, the law. And I wondered if I might ask you for a small additional courtesy. A number of thoughts about etiquette have already occurred to you, such as, who needs etiquette anyway? And who made up all those stupid etiquette rules? Probably a bunch of society matron busybodies. And I'm certainly not going to bother to learn them. People will have to understand that I simply don't care about etiquette, so if I violate any rules, it's not intentional. I'm certainly not going to follow any rules that I consider silly. All you need is common sense, and then etiquette will take care of itself. And what's important is to teach everybody to be nice to everyone else, and then you won't need anything as artificial as etiquette. People will say it's not for me. I'm just not comfortable with it, and everyone knows that etiquette is just for the rich, or that the rules are an instrument of oppression that interferes with your freedom as an individual. And I'll make my own rules. Thank you very much. Well, the favor that I'm asking you, as these insights occur to you, is to substitute in your mind the word law for etiquette or rules of etiquette. Why do we need law anyway? I didn't make all those stupid laws, so I'm not going to obey them. I can't be held responsible if I violate the law because I don't know what it is. I don't need law because I have common sense. And if we just teach everybody to be nice to everybody else, we won't need to have laws. Law only benefits the rich. It interferes with my freedom as an individual. And the main thing is that I need to be free to do what makes me feel comfortable. So I'll make my own laws. That sort of thing. Thank you. I just don't want you to have too good a time laughing at my discipline. We are too much in the same business and have presumably agreed that civilization, in which people do yield some autonomy in the cause of the general harmony, is better than a state of savagery, however noble the savage is, where each person is left to weigh his own self-interest and his voluntary willingness to show consideration and compassion for others against the common good. Etiquette is, in its way, a regulative system, just as law is, mandating codes of behavior, both written and unwritten, although I'm writing it down as fast as I can because I seem to be the only person left who remembers the oral tradition, unless there's anybody who would like to challenge me. Does anybody know what the correct day is for the ladies of the Supreme Court to receive? I suppose you're wondering, receive what? Well, it's Monday. So if there are any ladies present who are going to become Supreme Court justices, I hope they will remind their gentlemen to be at home to receive on Mondays. You see how easy it is to uptrade tradition. But within my lifetime, people stopped passing on the tradition to their children because the children started whining, oh, I want to be me, and for some reason the parents decided to let them rather than to try to civilize them. Etiquette is rooted in tradition, just as the law is, and it reflects a deep respect for the past. But it's conservative tradition notwithstanding, it is also constantly changing and being modified because social conditions change. Usually, etiquette changes are made in a slow evolutionary way. For example, we are now changing precedence systems from a gender-based system, ladies first, to what I think will eventually be one based on need or rank, where the disabled or the elderly or the boss goes first. But we're in that awkward stage right now where we have abolished the one and not yet instituted the other. So we currently have a precedent system known as get out of my way. Sometimes the changes in etiquette, as in law, are made as a result of direct challenging. For example, unmarried couples have demanded the right to be treated socially as a unit, whereas married couples have demanded the right to be socially treated as separate entities. The rules of etiquette change not only through time, diachronically, but also synchronically from place to place, so that different societies have different codes, but each obligates its members to know what is and what is not social behavior, which is where we're falling down right here. Nowadays, you have a situation where people will say, well, now I thought you gave me a present just because you wanted to, Grandma. I didn't know you expected a thank you note. Well, now, this never cuts any ice with Grandma because ignorance of the laws of etiquette of your own society, much less your own grandmother, are no excuse. Because etiquette is complex, and it is designed to regulate human behavior, which is even more complex, subtle judgments based on a knowledge of the rules and consideration of the motivations and the circumstances of the particular case are required when there are competing obligations. Did you stand me up for dinner because your mother died or because you met somebody more interesting last night at a salad bar? Are you making rude noises because you can't help it, or are you trying to be funny? It makes a difference. As in the law, provocation is somewhat taken into account, but much less than it is in the law, and much less than people seem to think when they are very proud of themselves and sometimes even expect me to commend them as my little helpers for replying to people who are rude to them by being even more rude, or perhaps just to increase the excitement violent in response. Well, I do not accept the defense for rude behavior of, well, he started it. Etiquette is, you won't believe this, but it is occasionally accused of fanning frivolous conflicts. And we who devote our lives to using etiquette to helping people are sometimes accused of fermenting trouble in order to show off our own knowledge and aggrandize ourselves. Have you ever heard of anything quite so unjust? And finally, because of the complexity of etiquette, there can be a wide range of opinion as to about how it applies in particular cases. Fortunately, there is a supreme authority to which one can appeal for ultimate and definitive judgments. And I'm delighted to be here. Let me distinguish two basically different components of etiquette. We have natural etiquette, physis or manners, and we have positive etiquette, nomos. Natural etiquette consists of the universal principles of polite behavior mandated by God and common to all societies because they could not be otherwise. Consideration for others, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and the concept that the strong should yield to the weak, for example. Now, what this means, of course, is that natural etiquette is against every instinct of human nature. Consideration of others. Show me a child who is born wanting to share his toys, and I will show you a child whose parents are about to clap him into psychotherapy. And the idea that the strong should yield to the weak seems to be a little less natural than, watch out, I'm bigger than you are. I hope this answers the question of why natural etiquette is not enough. And if it doesn't, I refer you back to, why do we need laws? Why can't we all just do what we feel like? Even being one of nature's true ladies or gentlemen with a genuine and unfailing goodwill toward others is not enough. You still have to carry a clean handkerchief or watch other people's goodwill evaporate when you're obviously in need of one. So we also require positive etiquette, with its arbitrary rules, which are adapted to the needs of a particular society at a particular time, although they may be entirely different from rules that another society of equally good-hearted people may have. And common sense will not help you dope these rules out. You can offend equally one society by not removing your shoes in its temples and another society by going barefoot in its churches. I came across once a wonderful etiquette book for a Japanese businessman contemplating coming to America, and it said, do not repeat, not remove your trousers in the aisle of the train, for putting a kimono on it does not go over well in America. Positive rules have several functions. They allow people to know what is expected of them. There's nothing more pitiful and bereft than a young teenager who has been told in a new situation, first boy-girl party or a job interview or something, oh, just act natural, which is a funny concept when you think about it. Act natural. Positive rules allow you to judge the intentions of others and whether they are friendly or hostile. Now, in this state of transition that we're in, it's a little difficult because, for example, a remark such as, really, you ought to do something about your body, used to be an insult. It's now been reclassified as a wonderful show of compassion for another human being. Positive rules help avoid or soften antagonisms. This is in direct contrast to the popular belief in the psychotherapeutic and moral value of clearing the air by saying everything that you think. Etiquette takes the position that people who are feeling surly ought to keep their big mouths shut till they feel better. But failing that, it requires antagonists to present opposing views in a restrained fashion. And thus, it is of tremendous value in providing an orderly and respectful structure in which conflict can be aired and resolved. And finally, positive rules provide adherents with the comfort and the feeling of belonging and the aesthetic satisfaction of shared traditions. For example, funeral rituals were designed to keep people both busy and out of the normal obligations of society when they couldn't cope with it. When you say, oh, just plunge in and we've abandoned that, and then you get people who go right out partying, being careful to say that the deceased would have wanted them to, which of course is nonsense. When you're dead, you want people to be so overcome with grief that they couldn't think of going partying. And then they have to be told it's all right to cry in situations where it obviously isn't. There's no question that observing the rules of etiquette restricts individual freedom. You do not have that great creative fun of inventing how to eat your lunch every day or whatever. How much fun that is another question, but people seem to want to claim that freedom. Observing etiquette definitely means that you cannot do whatever you want whenever you want to do it. That is the sacrifice that human beings are supposed to have made when we decided to live in communities. Now, what about the question of who makes these rules, the ones that God doesn't, and whom they most benefit? Well, traditions of positive etiquette, with their rules about speech and clothing and behavior, may be the work of particular religious or ethnic groups, of nationalities, of professions, of age groups such as teenagers, or subsocial units such as street gangs. And a stranger who seeks to enter such a community must learn its etiquette. Now, you will find some members of the community will welcome newcomers and help them learn the etiquette, and some of them, the old-timers, will use etiquette to try to keep the newcomers out, and then they will always be careful to say that they would love to have females, blacks, Hispanics, Jews, Americans, nouveau riche, or whatever, but unfortunately those people just don't know how to behave. This malign use of etiquette erodes its legitimacy and is a matter of great concern to people who are genuinely interested in manners, such as myself. We are the allies and not the tormentors of the disadvantaged. Etiquette is properly on the side of dignity and respect and not of discrimination. You may remember the unseemly carryings on at the Supreme Court before the first woman was appointed as a justice there. There were dire predictions that the etiquette would be wrecked, the question of precedence would be upset, and the question of what the female equivalent of Mr. Justice, which is what the justices were then called, was totally baffled the court. Well, this confusion led to the Burger Court's wrong-headed decision to drop the gender-related part of the title altogether. Ergo, the use of Mr. Chief Justice or Mr. Justice were deemed no longer proper, and henceforth they would be known, as they are now, simply as Justice. Here is an instance in which the law, unlike etiquette, is subject to institutional weaknesses of its decisional bodies. These can arise from a lack of sufficient time for reflective deliberation, the misuse of precedent, a failure to understand the facts, or a failure to recognize the appropriate application of comity. Had that learned body not overstepped its jurisdiction, and had it instead sought the advice of revered authority on the subject, the rationale would have been clearly reasoned and the result correct. I would have told them that a woman justice, single or married, should be styled Madam Justice. Etiquette presents no insurmountable problems for the cause for equality. Now, it is a serious charge that codes of etiquette are made by and for the rich, and that there's a sort of trickle-down process by which the poor ape these manners in a way that's both inappropriate and degrading. Admittedly, social classes do have their little codes of positive etiquette. Aristocracies are especially fond of rules that seem to symbolically convey the tradition, quality that is traditionally most admired by aristocracies, which is total uselessness. And they have little rules that pertain to the use of expensive objects, especially little silver thingamabobs. But these are a nuisance or challenge only to people who wish to change classes, which is an expensive hobby anyway. People of sense generally confine their social practices to the customs of their own circles. Outside of Restoration comedy, you really rarely have peasants running around the fields trying to behave like fops. But it would be a mistake to conclude from that a peasant class does not have its own strong sense of proper and improper behavior. In any case, a class changing, which used to be directed upwards, has sort of reversed itself and gone down, downwardly mobile climbing. I think people realize the advantage that has in annoying one's parents. And so social climbing is more often now of a pattern with what happened in the fashion industry, where the couture houses used to set the designs and then they would be adapted in the street. Now it's the other way around, and they're racing around trying to make expensive versions of street fashions because these are considered more vital to modern living. And so it is in etiquette. Which is not to say that the rudeness, which is now rampant in our society, represents the true behavioral standards of the poor, which in America, at least, were traditionally very strict and dignified, without any of the subservience and the indignities that were associated with lower classes and aristocratic societies. Rather, the present rudeness is a sort of lowest common denominator standard adapted by people who know better, sort of the way television producers will say, well, they know it's trash, but it's fit for the masses. The old-time upper-class etiquette used to maximize the expenditure of money, and you'd think it would be useful if they would now minimize the expenditure of money, but instead it has become a standard of minimizing the expenditure of effort. And the behavioral standard has become a comfort standard, of which the motto is, why bother? Such a warm feeling it gives you when your prospective hosts say, well, we're not going to bother at all when you come over. But there are more dangers in this standard for the poor than there are for the rich. The rich can much more easily buy their way out of the trouble that they create by antagonizing other people with their lack of manners. They have lawyers. And they can sometimes bribe people to treat them better. First class and deluxe and bribes given to haughty people are intended to purchase what used to be ordinary polite service that was available to all customers. And even this strategy isn't working very well anymore because buying respect has sort of been taken off the market nowadays. Now, economic power obviously does still make a difference. The rich can often fire or cause to be fired people whose behavior they don't like. And therefore, the poor need high standards of manners much more than the rich. They can't buy their way out of trouble or pay for decent treatment. And they can't command respect unless it's demanded of everyone, for everyone, by the rules of etiquette of the society. And in fact, the old rule of noblesse oblige was intended to redress the imbalance. The idea was that it is a much graver offense of etiquette to be rude to an employee, for example, than it is to be rude to your boss. The latter you can sort of pass off as courage, but you never can the former. And I think it's a terrible insult to the poor to maintain that since behaving in a civilized fashion is quite beyond them, the rich ought to lower their own standards and behave badly just to put them at ease. Well, what about the charge that the likes of me impose etiquette rules from above? I only wish. Etiquette rules represent, in a general way, and allowing for the fact that they don't change as quickly as the society does, a consensus about what people whom they actually govern encounter and what they find offensive or unworkable. Obviously, condemning an action and practicing it, of course, are not incompatible activities. And in fact, you might say there's less incentive to doing something wicked if, when the society says, oh, well, go ahead, who cares? This discovery between the rules of etiquette and reality was the basis for my original interest in etiquette, which sprang from an interest in history. I found that if you want to know what a given society was doing at a given time, look at their etiquette rules, because whatever they were being told not to do, that's what they were doing. You know, the Greek motto, nothing in excess, everything in moderation. People say, well, what sweet, dear, moderate people they must have been to put this on the wall. Well, nonsense. If they were moderate, they wouldn't have to write it up on the wall to remind themselves. If you want an idea of what the First Continental Congress must have looked like, I refer you to the etiquette rules that George Washington copied out as being most important for his time, some of which were, sleep not when others speak. And if you see any filth or thick spittle, put your foot dexterously upon it, if it be upon the clothes of others. And one of my favorites, which is, when in company, put not your hands to any part of the body not usually discovered. In addition to condemning offensive practices, positive etiquette has the function of supplying symbolic gestures for the expression of values. You know that handshaking is a friendly greeting. We hope that the current confusion, which seems to be replacing it, kissy-poo, is also a friendly gesture, although no two people can decide whether it's one cheek or two or whatever. You have gestures of greeting that symbolize rank, such as saluting. or subservience, such as bowing and curtsying, which of course I'm totally against for Americans, especially when they're British royalty on the shores and everybody goes down on their knees, forgetting that we do not owe allegiance to these people. It's amazing. People do this because they think, well, that's sort of fancy British manners, which is conceding that the British manners are better than the American manners, which I do not concede. And the British don't do it. British diplomatist Harold Nicholson wrote about this once. It went to a great deal of trouble to avoid kowtowing to Chinese emperors and such. Clothing, of course, is loaded with symbolic content in which common sense has little application. I mean, there's no sense arguing that you're more modestly dressed in your underwear than in your bathing suit. Symbolically, obviously, you're not. And you have uniforms by profession, some professions which actually issue them and grade them by rank, you know, the military, the clergy. You have professions that don't actually issue them, but funny thing, all the lawyers are wearing the blue suits and the $400 attaché cases. And there are regional and class standards, and even within those, etiquette sets different requirements of dress for the same people on different occasions. Nobody is sorrier than I am that the rules of etiquette cannot simply be invented and decreed by a benevolent autocrat who knows what's best for everyone, no matter who she happens to be and how right I am about everything. But one does need the consent of the governed, which is one reason that I do not associate myself with those old meanies who love to go to weddings and say very loudly that the bride is not entitled to wear a white dress. It's not the only reason that I don't do that. I think it's rather vulgar to examine the nuptial clothing for signs of how the courtship was conducted. But these people are fighting the consensus of the society, and they are going to lose. But even if it were possible to command obedience to etiquette by force, it would only mean that the system had fallen apart and that the society was being governed not by manners but by tyranny. So, how does a society motivate its individual members to obey its rules? A major problem in America right now. And unlike the law, the etiquette trade has a big problem with sanctions. A key question that probably occurred to you with those questions I mentioned earlier, but I hope you were too polite to utter, was, who's going to make me? Well, I could say I am, and your mother is going to help me. Or at least she's been trying, poor thing. She's exhausted. And I hope you're all ashamed of yourselves, because, in fact, shame is one of the few sanctions that we do have. The need for sanctions is acute because an ever-increasing number of people are defying the rules of etiquette of our own society now, and it's not just old cranks like me who can't stand the results. The worst etiquette anarchists are the people who also complain the most about being treated rudely. Last year, during the Penn Writers' Conference, Norman Mailer was the chairman, and there were a great many outbursts and people seizing the platform and yelling at one another, and he finally said, one of the ways in which everything is deteriorating is that manners in the world are getting a lot worse. Norman Mailer, the world is getting too rude for Norman Mailer. Well, why do people violate the rules of etiquette? There are many reasons. Some of them are good reasons, and some of them are bad. I suppose sometimes people do it for whatever meager fun they seem to get out of it. Every year I put down my absolute edict that you are not allowed to wear white shoes before Memorial Day or after Labor Day. And every year, there's an outcry over this. People who have been sitting there meekly while I have been telling them how to run their love lives and their families and their businesses, and they've been accepting it all, suddenly get upset about what color shoes to wear. And I keep thinking, there must be a law of etiquette that you can defy and have more of a thrill out of defying than wearing the wrong kind of shoes. But there you are. Then there are cognitive reasons for violating etiquette. ignorance of the rules. Now, for people who can be not be expected to know the rules, children and strangers, tolerance is expected. But there are a great many people who one would think would know the rules. People who give parties know that you have to answer invitations because they have to know how many people who are going to dinner. But people who go to parties are an entirely different society, and they say, no, you don't have to answer invitations anymore, nobody cares, and what's more, the hosts are delighted when you show up with a few extra people. Sometimes people violate etiquette laws because they are lazy or careless. We at a time when everything has been miniaturized, we are all, it seems, carrying an enormous amount of junk around. Tote bags and knapsacks and shoulder bags and carry-on luggage. And nobody seems to have made an allowance for how that changes the human silhouette. So you have aisles in buses and airplanes where people are merrily banging into one another and not knowing it, or pretending they don't know it. People may violate etiquette rules out of hostility. Now, there are perfectly proper ways of expressing hostility. One of the old-fashioned ones was slapping people across the face with your gloves. People sometimes ask me why I still carry gloves. Well, you never know. But to do it rudely, I mean, it's rude to hang up on people, but there's a proper way to do everything. You say, good day to you, madam or sir, and then you hang up on them. That's proper. Sometimes there are special circumstances which actually make people unable to comply with the rules. You may have a problem with your hand. You can't shake hands, for example. Medical disorders and religious excuses, convictions, are properly accepted as excuses when they are valid. I do not personally accept the self-diagnosis of depression for what we used to call the blues as an excuse for any human behavior. And an awful lot of people are claiming allergies when they mean they don't like something. This is an old habit from your childhood when you claim to be allergic to your veggies. Then there are ideological reasons for violating etiquette. Sometimes people are naive about the very idea of convention, and so they try to regulate their behavior by a sort of do-it-yourself analysis of what ought to be done, using logic or common sense rather than learning what is done. These are the people who, when they're thanked for using AT&T, feel called upon to explain to the operator that they didn't mean to use A&T, they had no choice, AT&T. And by the same token, that they don't understand that there are conventions about avoiding things. So if they want to know if somebody got pregnant on purpose, they ask her. Some people are unable to tolerate obliqueness and ambiguity, which is very often the only way we have of disguising feelings that would be intolerable if we had to deal with them in other people. And then there are the merry souls who see life as a theater with unlimited creative opportunities for reinventing human behavior as an expression of self. This is called, that's not an etiquette error, that's my lifestyle. There are people who defy rules in a serious way to disassociate themselves from what they interpret the symbolic content to be. That may not always be what is intended. Not everybody who holds a door open intends to imply that the other person is too weak to open the door, him or, I'm afraid, herself. But it is often interpreted as that, and people will reject it. Or people will hold the belief that a knowledge of etiquette is itself symbolic of pretentiousness or other undesirable traits, and that know-nothingism is a better evidence of goodwill than attention to social customs. This is sort of real people don't dress up type of thinking. And there are people who legitimately wish to associate themselves with standards other than those maintained by the society in which they find themselves, and they practice rules that violate the mainstream society but might show allegiance to another. Expatriates retaining their own national customs in a foreign country, for instance, for example, a Western woman dressing Western style in a country where women are in purdah. Or teenagers fighting a losing battle to distinguish themselves from the grown-ups, who, of course, fool them by copying everything they can think of as quickly as they can think of it. Finally, that there are people who will defy the rules of etiquette in the interests of provoking social change, and that is how social change often comes about. But as in any form of civil disobedience, the penalties fall hardest on the idealistic pioneers, the first people to refuse to make the office coffee or to come out of the closet, and so on. The strategy is most successful when it's focused on particular changes, and it's a legitimate strategy, instead of people attempting to throw over all customs all at once, which is an impossible task. Given the variety and the circumstances and motivations for all these infractions, etiquette does have available a variety of remedies for minimizing the damage that is done by violating etiquette. Tolerance for the unwitting that I mentioned. Polite people do not sneer at foreigners or other people who are unlikely to be versed in their particular ways. They graciously ignore their errors. And the violators themselves can mitigate the sting by supplying acceptable reasons, apologizing with flowers, or, depending on the degree of the offense, groveling. Of course, in this, I'm presuming that these people want to clear things up and contain the damage. But suppose they don't. Suppose they're doing it for the damage. It's generally not unintentional when drivers make certain gestures to other people on the highway, for example. Well, what can the aggrieved party do about being the target of a deliberate violation and, well, respond in kind, of course, which is what they are doing, but that does not serve the cause of etiquette. More importantly, what can the society do about its rules being so widely flouted that the general irritation level in daily life is almost unbearable? Well, the situation here is more comparable to that's faced by the community of nations in attempting to compel compliance with international law. In both cases, when people defy etiquette or nations violate international law, the violators are sovereign agents over whom the legislator lacks the authority of enforcement, and therefore the only sanctions that are available are public opinion, shame, and shunning the wrongdoer. Well, as the history of international law has shown, these are not terrific weapons. The catch is that in order to inflict shame, you have to have the consent of the shamee to feel ashamed. Nevertheless, this used to work fairly well, not in international law, heaven knows, but in etiquette. Believe it or not, none of you will remember this, but there was a time when someone who behaved at what was grandly known as a disgrace to humanity actually had his chances lessened of getting invited to chic dinner parties and not increased. But there is now a dearth of social spaces in which to register this shame because of the mobility of the society, the social and the geographical and even the marital mobility, if I can put it that way, of the society. And you do need a stable social circle in which to maintain or to ruin a good reputation. And another factor, I think, in the problem today is that there is a crisis of confidence in the society in the belief that there are any rights and wrongs in social behavior. Many people who realize that the rules of positive etiquette are arbitrary, as they are, conclude that therefore no one has the right to impose them on anyone else. With this goes the socially subversive notion that it is wrong for anyone to pass judgment on anyone else. Except, of course, people do it all the time. I mean, any casual acquaintance will tell you that the food that you're eating is killing you, and you ought to exercise more, and you paid too much for your house, and it's about time you got married. It's merely the failure to live up to the standards of civilized behavior that is thought to be beyond criticism. Now, I am certainly in favor of sympathy and tolerance. I didn't go into the etiquette business in order to advocate vengeance and ostracism. But wiping out the concept of responsibility, excusing a priori anyone who commits any wrong on the grounds of his having been under a terrible strain, can only lead to the disintegration of social intercourse. And it is a grave disservice to the victims of this bad behavior and to society at large, which is then faced with the impossible task of living without standards. It seems to be a current rule of etiquette, for instance, that if someone tries to shoot you, the proper response, presuming that you live to make the proper response, is to say, why the poor person, he must be awfully sick to do such a thing. Now, I happen to think that's charming. But it is less charming when other people rally to express sympathy for the assailant while neglecting to do so for the victim. And that's the point to which we have gotten. Well, now let me turn for a minute to etiquette as an institution for the resolution of social conflicts. This has the great virtue, to people who are not in this room, of being cheaper than going to law. When people refuse to recognize and obey the demands of etiquette, those who object have no alternative but to resort to law. For example, the smoking issue. Now, once upon a time, there was a very elaborate etiquette for keeping smoke away from non-smokers. Non-smokers at that time were known as ladies, and smokers were known as gentlemen. And smokers were expected to smoke only among themselves, and there were special smoking rooms and even smoking jackets so that the clothing would not contain odors that would offend the non-smokers. It was strictly an etiquette system, and it worked. But it fell into disuse when ladies started smoking in public, and now smoking behavior is left up to everybody's goodwill. And look at it. And, of course, the whole business has gotten incredibly nasty, and it has landed in the courts. When etiquette was allowed to put some restraints on name-calling, I believe there was less need to sue for slander or libel. I think there is a definite correlation between the breakdown of etiquette and the increased amount of litigation. Etiquette compensates for the failure of human nature, and the law, in turn, I believe, exists to compensate for the failures of etiquette. But the law is indebted to etiquette for much more than throwing a little business your way. Let me get back now to two uses of etiquette that I mentioned before. One is defining allegiance, and the other is creating a structure within which conflicts may be resolved. Why is strict etiquette so necessary in the courtroom that it is not left to voluntary compliance as it is in society? In contrast to the ever-increasing informality in most other transactions and professions, courtroom procedure conserves a very rigid etiquette, and there are rules governing minutely such matters as attire, salutations, forms of address, standing and sitting, and manner of time of speaking. Why? The answer is that the etiquette of the courtroom, in which the conflicts to be resolved are obviously more severe than those that etiquette deals with in the salon or on the street, needs to be as strong as possible for a human institution. What other professions have that kind of strict attention to dress and to form? Well, the military, sports, the church, diplomacy. Professions that are loaded with emotional weight and conflict. The more structured the form, the more argument it can support. The rules of courtroom etiquette are designed to inspire respect for and allegiance to the authority of the law. Obviously, the judge in his robes, or in British jurisprudence still in his wig, is meant to represent not just somebody well-versed in the law who wandered in his street clothes like everyone else, but the will of the people of the state. And at the same time, generally, people want to court the goodwill of the judge, and it is easier if the rules are known and the standards of behavior are known to follow them in a way that you are confident will be pleasing. In addition, etiquette keeps the conflicts on a manageable level. Now, we all know what is meant by a statement such as, "My distinguished colleague seems to be unfortunately misinformed." But when you say something like that, you can go on to the matter at hand. If you put it in the common parlance and you say, "That bastard is lying," you have a fist fight and not an argument. Formality offers a set pattern which is known in advance and therefore at least is intended to be more objective than something that people are improvising on the spot and is certainly more orderly. And what do you get when courtroom etiquette breaks down? Well, you get the Chicago 7 trial and the Black Panther trials and the various trials that comprise the Great Court Etiquette Rebellion of 1970. Abby Hoffman declared that decorum itself was an instrument of repression, and among them, the Chicago 7 managed to break an impressive number of etiquette rules. Addressing the judge by his first name, offering him some informal advice, wearing their own judicial robes, putting their feet on the tables and chairs, speaking, shouting at will, using profanity, and just generally not being very genteel. Well, the judges in these cases fought back with the only weapon they had, which was contempt of court, and with such maneuvers as having the defendants manacled and gagged or removed from the courtroom, which in turn violated the conditions of a fair trial, which the defendant has a right to be present and in a manner not prejudicial to the jury. So as you know, the eventual outcome was the concession that a trial simply cannot be conducted when the etiquette of the courtroom is violated, and the Supreme Court ruled that a misbehaving defendant may be removed from the courtroom. Well, there were a lot of people who were horrified at the pitting of mere etiquette against holy legal rights. And in finding out that the right to be present at your own trial, guaranteed by the 6th and 14th Amendments, could be forfeited by failure to observe etiquette. This does not horrify me. Even I don't claim that etiquette is more important than legal rights. But I do complain. I do claim that compliance with etiquette is a prerequisite for any form of civilization, including the majestic structure of the law. Without etiquette, a social contract under which we adhere voluntarily to some intelligible and non-threatening code of behavior, civilized living and its refinements, such as law, are unthinkable. The very act of complying with the rules of etiquette is a pledge of allegiance to the concept of community, and I believe to civilization itself. It's a symbolic willingness to abide by law and the acknowledgement that people must regulate their behavior in the interests of the general harmony. So the thought that you cannot have law without etiquette may trouble the legal mind, but I assure you it does not trouble the etiquette mind. Thank you very much. I would be happy to answer any questions. About law or the etiquette? Or etiquette, yes. I think if you step to the microphone, please. I think this, yes.
Could you comment a little bit on the etiquette of being a syndicated columnist?
It's an extremely genteel thing to do. And I recommend it.
Maybe specifically commenting on the ways in which a readership or your editor or whoever you are responsible to might have some influence on what you write.
The readership has a tremendous influence on what I write because half the column is written by the readership. It took me some 25 years in the newspaper business to discover how much easier that makes one's life. People write in letters, and I feel very fortunate because I have a readership that write what I consider very interesting, witty letters. My editor is kind enough not to try to attempt to control me.
Ms. Manners, could you suggest how to handle an acquaintance or a friend of a friend who uses ethnically or racially pejorative terms in a casual conversation?
This is a classic instance in which you do not do what most people assume you always have to do in etiquette, which is to make other people feel comfortable. What you want to do in a case like that is to make the other person feel uncomfortable. And the polite way to do that is with a freezing smile. Someone tells a ethnic joke, and if you wanted to make that person feel comfortable, you would laugh, and you give the impression that you shared the prejudice and so on. If you look at the person like this, you will make him feel very uncomfortable, and you will disassociate yourself from the rudeness.
I'd like to know how you could politely inform someone that you would rather attend their wedding as a guest as opposed to being
the bride
party. No, not the bride. No, something else like that.
You don't want to be in the wedding party.
Correct.
Well, you say, my schedule and my life is such right now, I would not be able to do it justice to being having the honor of being one of your attendants.
That's good.
Besides, I hate the dress. No, you don't say that.
Ms. Manners?
Yes.
My brother is getting married this weekend, and here's the problem. It's an increasing problem, I guess, today. My father and mother have been divorced for about 6 years now and are decidedly not on good terms. My father and his fiancée will be attending the wedding, but my mother will be attending alone. There are just two questions I have. First, although my father is adamant on the point, is it proper for him and his fiancée to be seated at the bridal table at the dinner following the wedding without my mother? And the second thing is, who should be seated in the front pew of the church? Is it appropriate, well, obviously on the groom's side, is it appropriate that that my father's fiancée not be, or is it all right if she is seated in the front pew along with my father and presumably also my mother?
The overriding rule is that you separate people who are likely to hit each other. Your father's fiancée, that's a quasi-official position, certainly has a right to attend and will accompany your father. I would put your mother in the front pew and your father and his fiancée in the second, if you can trust that, in the third, if not. Grown-ups are supposed to behave themselves under such circumstances. A wedding is not, as many people seem to think, the opportunity to restage an old divorce. The wedding itself is supposed to be the center of attention. The bridal table is not a problem because that is the bridal couple and their attendants at one table, and then parental tables. You can have more than one, and I certainly would in this instance.
The bridal table is going, they're not going to have the attendants, so the parents are actually going to be seated with the couple.
Put them at far ends. And tell your mother that she will come off much better if she is utterly charming to your father's fiancée. This is an example in which politeness is so much more effective than rudeness. In these instances, a woman who is rude to her successor, as it were, shows that she has hurt feelings. The woman who is utterly charming, almost to the point of extreme gratitude to someone... gives the distinct impression that she was awfully happy to get him off her hands. And we'll make that woman feel decidedly uncomfortable if that is her objective. And nobody can fault her on it because it's polite. So tell her from me.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Ms. Martin, I've been wondering about this for some time, having read your book. Why is sable the only appropriate fur for mourning?
Because it is. I'm afraid law school has warped your mind, perhaps, to thinking that there is a reason for everything. Etiquette is, to a great extent, folklore. And it is done that way because we do it that way.
Thank you.
A lot of people say today that you should pay your respects while people are alive instead of when they're dead. Is that just an excuse for not complying to funeral.
If they say that after the person is dead, it's definitely an excuse. Yes, you should pay your respects while people are alive. And by the way, the classic example of very natural behavior that is disgusting and uncivilized are people who, in fact, will shun the critically ill or the dying because it makes them feel uncomfortable. That is natural behavior, and one reason that natural behavior is no defense in etiquette. But how you behave during the person's lifetime does not excuse you if you obviously ought to be attending the funeral from attending it. Those are those people I mentioned who say, he would have wanted me to go to the baseball game. Nonsense.
Thank you.
Would have wanted you to throw yourself in his open grave.
Hello. An individual which I had had dinner with twice sent me an Easter bouquet with a note that said, when will I see you again? And how do I tell this person politely that I'm not interested?
You send back a letter saying, thank you so much for the flowers. They were beautiful.
Okay. Thank you very much.
If somebody invites you somewhere and you just don't want to go, should you make up an excuse and lie to them, or should you just say, no, I don't want to go?
Neither of the above. How people can get through life without knowing how to say no in a way that makes it stick, I don't know. Life is full of situations one must reject. And the trick is to say no, which is a simple, easy word, and then to shut up. So you do not make up the elaborate excuse and say, well, no, but in next June I expect to be attending a funeral, because you're going to be caught. And you do not say, I don't want to, which is an example of unpleasant honesty. You say, no, thank you very much. I would love to, but I can't. And should the person be so rude as to say, why not? You say, because unfortunately it's just not possible. Well, thank you all very much. Pleasure to be here.